All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a freezing 41 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show BMW, Alexa, Nanobots and Chips. Injectable AI, an evolution to destruction. We looked at a lot of things. We had continued on from Friday's show looking at voice assistants and what happens to some of that data as you are using your voice to control the machine. It's saved up to the server and it can be used in a criminal investigation at some point in your not too distant future. We also looked at all kinds of new little nanobots that are coming onto the market. There are ones that can cure ulcers in mice and others that 20 years from now, they say, are going to be in our body repairing us and fixing organs. At the very end of the show, I had started covering a story about mind-controlled nanobots used to release chemicals in living cockroaches. And we had covered this story at the time when this first came out. I was very horrified. Even though they're cockroaches, you have to wonder why they are doing experiments such as these and where they are going to end up. I think that we are going to go micro to macro today. I found some interesting things while I was browsing the news early hours this morning. So mind-controlled nanobots used to release chemicals in living cockroaches out of SingularityHub.com, September 18th, 2016. This is wild. A team of Israeli scientists developed a contraption that uses a person's brainwaves to remotely control DNA-based nanobots. Now, we just read a story about the brand new DNA-based nanobots, little arms and legs that can walk around, while the nanobots were inside of the living cockroach. When prompted by human thought, the clamshell-like robots opened up, revealing a drug-like molecule that tweaked the physiology of the cockroach's cells. Though merely a demonstration and proof of concept, of course it was, the technology represents a new era of brain nanomachine interfaces that links a person's mental state, ding, ding, to bioactive payloads such as drugs. I mean, this is like a wet dream for the controllers, isn't it? All they got to do is think about it. Don't piss him off. He's going to release the forever coma drug. just by one little thought. I mean, this is unbelievable. I'm going to talk about Elon Musk and kind of some of the stuff he's been working on. And I always said you got to love to hate him. And I never really knew if I trusted him. But I got to tell you, I dug up some stuff now that I don't think I trust him at all. Future techniques that build upon this prototype could be helpful for, of course, schizophrenia, depression, and other mental disorders, in that the drugs only activate when a patient's brain waves show signs of abnormality. Well, so much for all of us individual thinkers out there. Hacking a cockroach's bodily functions with our thoughts is pretty cool by itself, but scientists developed their technology with another goal in mind: to solve a thorny problem in drug delivery. Getting drugs to go where you want is extremely difficult, especially for drugs that work inside the brain. When we pop a neuroactive pill, like Adderall or Ritalin for ADHD, the active ingredients circulate in the body. Some get destroyed by the liver, lowering efficacy, and others rampage through the bloodstream, often causing side effects. Scientists have tried to work around this by encapsulating drugs in different pill coatings or gels to delay the release, or maybe even gelatin nanobots. And even these systems aren't completely controllable, since there is no way to shut them off once the coating peels away. But a few years ago, of course, a team from Harvard, led by Georgie Porgy Church, came up with an exotic solution, and that would be DNA origami nanorobots. Now, what's interesting about this is the home of the RoboBees, which, if I'm not mistaken, was Harvard. Maybe not. Maybe it was. Home of the RoboBees and the Weiss Institute came up with the origami capability of mass manufacturing for mini robots. And then to find out George Church is involved, which makes a lot of sense because he has a lot of connecting dots to those institutions, really is a kicker. Shaped like clamshells, these nanoscale robots are made from strands of synthetic DNA molecules. So let's add the synthetic DNA as well, that encapsulate the drug payload until it is time for delivery. And unlike controlled release pills, the drug is physically tethered to the shell, so it is never physically free to roam the body. Instead, the payload only works when the clamshell is open. Clamp it shut and you immediately block off the drug. The opening of the nanobot is controlled by two locks, each one a special strand of DNA called an aptamer that binds to a target molecule, a receptor on the surface of a cancer cell, for example. And when the aptamer locks onto the target, the clamshell unzips, delivering the payload. I wonder how much it would take to put a CRISPR cutting payload inside one of those little clamshells. These nanorobots are the first systems that approach real arbitrary control of therapeutic molecules, wrote the Israeli team in the paper. But they require us to find specific molecular targets presented in disease but not normal states for the robot to bind to. So let's target normal states of being and be able to get them with some of our newfangled drugs. I mean, that's the disturbing part of this. Who is going to be making the decisions as to whether or not you are defective and in need of some sort of quote-unquote therapy with the nanobots? Let them go. 50 million coming right up your nose. It's horrifying. Anyone who's ever been a fan of science fiction, like I've been since I was a kid, and have seen like The Replicators. I don't remember. Was that Deep Space? No, Babylon 5, I think, had The Replicators. Or maybe it was Star Trek. I don't know. It was one of them. But they had all these millions of little nanobots that could get into your ship and into your electronics and disassemble things and do all kinds of crazy stuff. And when we think back to the story we read yesterday about those little magnetically controlled robots that were actually building things, they're picking up carbon nanotubes and gluing them and ultravioleting them together to build structures. We're going to look at a little more of those micro robots. It was out of a company called SRI. Anyway, so back to these little clamshells to release drugs in your body. The opening of the nanobot is controlled by two locks. We looked at that. These nanorobots are the first system that approach real arbitrary control of therapeutic molecules. They require us to find specific targets, but presented in disease, but not in normal states for the robot to bind to. That is already hard for cancer. For mental disorders, it's nearly impossible. Well, thank goodness for DNA nanorobots to work in these conditions. We need other modes of control. That got the team thinking. Since mental disorders are often accompanied by the telltale signs of abnormal brain activity that can be picked up by an EEG, what if we use the brain waves to control the DNA nanobots and the drug release? Remember, this is the experiment that was going on inside the cockroach. So to test their data, the team rigged a simple proof-of-concept system that can be further optimized for actual therapeutic use, and that would be in humans. First, they trained an algorithm to distinguish between the EEG patterns of people at rest or performing vigorous mental arithmetic. Then they linked a fluorescent molecule, and that would be, remember Georgie Porgy Church was using fluorescent molecules to bag and tag neurons. They linked a fluorescent molecule, the drug payload, to their DNA robots, tagged them with iron nanoparticles, and then injected the bots into the bellies of live cockroaches that were placed inside of electromagnetic coils. The iron nanoparticles are the key. The aptamers were previously, as they acted as the locks controlling the DNA robot. The human wearing an EEG cap sat next to the system and, when prompted, either mentally relaxed or solved math problems. The brainwaves were decoded in real time and used to change the state of the electromagnetic coil, powering it on during calculations. So turn off that higher thinking ability. Beep! The shift in the electromagnetic field heated the iron nanoparticles, which in turn unlocked the clamshells, exposing the fluorescent molecule. And within 18 seconds after field activation, the scientists detected fluorescence in the cockroach, confirming that the rig had worked as planned. And what is more, when the human controller mentally relaxed, the DNA clamshell gates reclosed and the fluorescence disappeared, suggesting that the robots were still physically intact and had successfully deactivated. This is insane. The authors believe that the future designs of this technology could be used to automatically trigger drug release in humans when required. When you start thinking about Tommy Insel, the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, going over to Google's Verily division to work on mental health applications and ways to treat people and to pull real-time diagnostics, these technologies are pretty frightening. And then you look at the 21st Century Cures Act with the entire mental health section and non-invasive technologies to control them. The algorithm then can be trained to track brain states that underlie ADHD or schizophrenia or otherwise be modified to suit your needs, explained study author Sachar Anand to New Scientist, the magazine. For example, if the EEG detects signs of a burgeoning depression mode, it could trigger the DNA robots to expose antidepressants briefly to counteract symptoms before they become full-blown. This way, the brain isn't perpetually bathed in mind-altering drugs, even when they are not needed. It is a futuristic idea, and lots of things still need to be ironed out. There is a challenge of taking it into the real world, says study author Dr. Doran Friedman to Singularity Hub. If you remember, there was a big neurological partnership that was going on between the United States and Israel. So interesting that, and I think there was also an incubator funding group that was a part of that for funding new innovations in neuropsychiatric inventions to cure mental disorders. And although there is some trend toward wearable technologies, it is still very difficult to measure high-quality EEG signals from people in everyday life. For the system to work as planned, the team envisions a hearing aid-like EEG device that continuously and inconspicuously monitors brain activity. I wonder if that's an implant. And when abnormalities occur, it triggers a wearable, for example, smartwatch, glasses, or jewelry to create the electromagnetic fields required to expose the drug. But even decoding brain activity is hard. And at the moment, we can find some differences in EEGs between patients with mental disorders and controls in the lab, he says. However, Having a reliable neural marker that works in real time is a different problem, and that is what Tommy Insel was really looking for. That's the holy grail, to be able to manipulate and control what is going on inside of your head, is to come up with a real-time neuromarker that can show a real-time diagnosis versus just answering questionnaires, and one that we are actively working on, he says. Nevertheless, the team is optimistic their invention can go quite far, and we have just scratched the surface, he says. In this study, the team used brain activity as a trigger signal. However, other parameters should be equally effective at controlling the DNA bots, and this data is becoming increasingly accessible along with the Internet of Things. For example, heart monitoring applications, ding, ding, already available for mobile devices, and I have one of those little doctor smartphones here, and some are working on gadgets that track blood sugar and other bodily parameters, and Google's Verily division was working on that contact lens that would detect and treat diabetes, taking your sugar levels out of your tears. A similar contraption could help us self-mediate when needed, with a thought we could trigger patrolling DNA robots to release melatonin to soothe those sleepless nights, or caffeine to perk us up. Oh, that would be a dangling carrot to sell, that one. Here, get your DNA nanobot caffeine pill. It saves you time in the morning. You don't even have to get out of bed to brew coffee. Just think about it, and you will have caffeine caressing through your veins. We could even get ourselves to the perfect level of drunk. Oh, and it releases alcohol. Just think about getting drunk. Tell us what level of drunk you want to be. There you go, Johnny. And then climb into your self-driving car. With just a thought, you can order one. Blink your eyes twice. I mean, this is just insanity. Imagine you could deliver the exact amount of alcohol that you wanted. I knew it, to keep you happy, but not quite drunk. Kind of stupid, but this could happen, says Arnon. And then there is the issue of security. What countermeasures need to be in place to prevent other people's thoughts from controlling our physiology? It seems that we still have a lot of work to do, but take note, we may have just glimpsed the beginning of mind over body. Yes, well, now with little DNA robots inside of you, you can do anything. So yesterday, we read about these little nanobots that were magnetically controlled that could build things with little carbon nanotubes and glue. The company was named SRI, and I found an update to the story that we had read yesterday, and I think it was either 4 or 6 years into the future. SRI's micro robots can now manufacture their own tools. Now, imagine a legion of these being released accidentally or on purpose into the environment to have a task. And not only can they run around and do things when they're exposed to a magnetic field, and as we have a lot of these new things being launched into our atmosphere and these experiments happening with radio propagation and plasma bombing the sky, then we also found out that some of these experiments that are going on from things such as CERN, I don't know if I ever talked about this, but I was doing some research into the magnetosphere, and I had to come across a few disturbing things. And one was that CERN was working on an experiment on how to, and I don't know if this was accidentally or on purpose, but there were a few of these things that were like, whoops, look at what we just found. Look at what one of the side effects of some of the experiments we've been doing have caused. And one of them was creating an artificial magnetosphere. And then I read a little bit further that they were actually talking about utilizing that artificial magnetosphere on future space missions to be able to protect the astronauts from space radiation. Now, you know, we've asked that question before with the weight of lead, and back in the 1960s with a computer as powerful as a personal calculator, how did they ever navigate and launch that type of weight outside of the atmosphere? I don't know. Lots and lots and lots of questions. If you've never questioned it before, start looking into it, because back in my past, I'd never questioned it at all, some of the things that we were told. And one of my friends and I started talking one night about some of the particulars of going into space, and some of the weight that would be required and some of the technology that is required and why we don't have a Disney World on the moon. I think that that is probably some of my biggest proof. Where is Disney World on the moon, guys? Because if we were the type of society that we pretend to be with commercialism everywhere, and, you know, everyone's going to spend a little bit extra for a supersonic vacation, why not have a Disney World on the moon? Or at least a Space 1999. Anyway, a few years ago, SRI International introduced their micro factory platform. We read about that yesterday, in which it uses hundreds of tiny robots, each one smaller than a dime, to cooperate to build macro scale structures like trusses, which can even contain integrated electronics. Such complex manufacturing requires cooperation between many different micro-robots, each one outfitted to perform a specific task. Building a bunch of little custom bots is, we have to assume, a little bit tedious, so SRI has developed a tool shop for their micro-factory that can make custom end effectors for micro-robots on demand. Well, let's launch this up to Mars, Elon. SRI's micro-robots are really just small magnets. All of the intelligence is built into the substrate that they travel on. Printed circuit boards drive them along electromagnetically with the ability to control their speed and movement in two axes as well as rotationally. And we read that the guy who built this little micro factory also built a piece of software that does a lot of the automation. Here's a video from 2014, and if you wanted to watch it, I will link to this story from IEEE Spectrum in the notes of the show. And the video shows two different micro-robots doing lots of different tasks, but you will notice that fundamentally the robots look identical except for their end effectors. These end effectors have to be altered depending on what you want the micro-robot to do, which in practice means that you need to build a bunch of different micro-robots. SRI has been experimenting with ways of adapting standard micro-robots into customized platforms designed for specific tasks by fabricating tools for them, which is a much more efficient way to do things. And it's a little bit hard to tell what is going on in these clips, so we talked to Ron Pierline, principal scientist at SRI International, to get all the details. You are looking at an individual millimeter scale magnet being driven into an incubator structure, which is a glass slide with copper wire spaces sitting on a microfactory surface that causes them to assemble into an array. And in this particular case, the array forms a V-shape, but it is arbitrary, and different incubators can be used to create whatever shape you like. Once the array is formed, it can be controlled by multiple degrees of freedom as one single micro or slightly less micro robot, allowing it to act as a mobile manipulator. The next clip shows how SRI's micro-robots can construct their own tools. This can be done on a single micro-robot or an array of micro-robots that have been formed into larger manipulators, as in the first clip, and the active robot that is doing all the work made of two units that are put together supporting a little bit of structure with a probe on it. Inside the darkish cylinder is a curable liquid that turns from a liquid to a solid as it dries, and the micro-robot with probes picks up a droplet of this curable liquid and then sticks it onto the corner of a waiting micro-robot where it hardens, and then the micro-robot zips over to the blue cylinder to rinse its probe off to prevent unwanted buildup of the curable liquid. This process is repeated over and over again until you've got the tool you need, which would be a hook or a fork, and it is additionative manufacturing process that in some ways is similar to 3D printing, and that over time, small bits of material come together to create something useful. All of this takes place in an area of just a few square inches of space, and it vastly increases the utility of micro-robots like these. Pearline says that think of the micro-factory tool shop in much the same way as you would a tool shop in a macro-factory that services a significant number of robots rather than having a tiny bunch of special-purpose robots to complete tasks that may change. You just buy standardized robots in a bigger factory and outfit them with special-purpose tools that you fabricate yourself on-site. It is faster, cheaper, and more efficient. And additionally, a tool shop like this opens up possibilities for repairing tools or even repairing entire robots on-site, making the entire micro-factory system more robust. robustness, flexibility, and independence are going to be crucial if the microfactories are deployed, let's say, in space, wink, or perhaps on another planet like Mars, which there are two places where they would be incredibly useful. Now, these micro-robots can also make their own tools. The same fleet of robots can be reconfigured to make all kinds of different things. And I was just wondering if somewhere in here they're going to talk about them making their own additional micro-robots, because that's what you have to worry about. SRI is focused on construction, strong, lightweight carbon fiber trusses within its microfactory, but they have recently started developing ways to make skins. Laying skins on top of arrays of trusses create sandwiched panels, which are lightweight and very stiff structural components commonly used to make durable walls and roofs. Perlene says that we should see some examples of this new construction in the next few months. SRI is also working on ways of controlling magnetic micro robots with levitation instead of sliding locomotion, which is relatively low precision. Magnetic levitation could also allow the micro-robots to be positioned at a resolution of something like 200 nanometers, and that level of precision is in an inherently low-cost system, according to Pirline, offers a very competitive advantage over conventional automation. He explained that eventually the micro-factory technology could expand outside of manufacturing and achieve integration with other robotic systems. Oh no! Imagine micro-robots living inside of larger robots or people monitoring them and performing maintenance and repairs. Borg nanites, basically, except not evil nanites, we hope. Borg nanites, what? Now guys, this is absolute lunacy. Now anybody who's for the 21st century Internet of Things and becoming one of them should reconsider when they think of what this could mean and how control at a micro level will make us being choked like the t-shirt I talked about yesterday. I really can't wait to get that t-shirt where the robot is choking humanity and taking all of humanity and making it under its control. All right, so the Internet of Things, the giant network of clever talking devices, becomes a reality out of SputnikNews.com. Turn on a coffee machine, switch to another TV channel, and close the garage with the press of a button. The science fiction movie scenario that had previously seemed impossible has already become a reality. More and more companies have started using revolutionary technology known as the Internet of Things that allows us to connect various objects through a global network and make your life easier and safer, or maybe not. While this new system that automates human activities is rapidly gaining popularity, remember all those little micro-robots are going to be connected as well. Sputnik spoke with analysts about the pros and cons of this phenomenon and learned how it might influence people's lives in the future. The Internet of Things is a giant network of things, which includes everything from cell phones, coffee machines, lamps, doors, small wearable devices, and almost any other item one can think of, including nanobots. And the connectivity devices literally talk to each of us. And it could be a smart fridge that tells you in advance that you are out of milk or that your car chooses the best route for your next meeting because it has access to your calendar. It is commonly used as Apple TV and as Chromecast, and they allow us to share content from our mobile phone or tablet or computer, as well as order food from home and soon to be with Alexa. Another example is voice support, and there we go. Application Alexa, developed by Amazon, which responds to voice commands, shows movies, reports about traffic jams, and reads audiobooks to its owner. The range of application for this type of technology is very wide, and it is going to usurp us, and it helps us to increase productivity in different industries. In agriculture, the technology is being used to learn the rate at which plants grow, the level of light they receive, or the required amount of water to grow them. And we're going to look at automating farmland. Livestock industry benefits from this tool by measuring the production of milk of the reproductive cycles of animals. It is also useful in the area of healthcare. And yeah, not just for animals, but also for people caring for the elderly with sensors being put in different parts of the house will help to determine whether a person takes their medicine or let them swallow their CRISPR pill or eat their little nano gelatin robot to see what's in their stomach or whether he or she is in need of help. And where there is no internet, devices and sensors can store information until a connection appears again. However, not everything is as cloudless as it might seem at first sight. Many analysts are concerned about security with regards to the Internet of Things, but don't worry about it because the government's going to step in and help you with all that. And with billions of objects with their AI sentry called Mayhem, with billions of objects being connected to each other, it is very difficult to make sure that a person's information stays secure. Thus, companies still need to figure out how to protect the system. If, for example, someone wants to hack your coffee machine and get access to your entire data network. So now we have an autonomous robot, September 11th, 2017, that plants, tends to, and harvests an entire crop of barley. Agriculture is no stranger to autonomy. Tractors were among the first commercial autonomous vehicles. And did you know that they use triangulation with cell phones and GPS to direct them in the fields? Because I only found that out just recently. There's a huge market for drones packed with sensors that can help farmers make more informed decisions. The problem is, though, that farming is still work for humans, and there is still dirt, early mornings, dirt, and more dirt, and lots of hard work that involves some extra dirt. All this dirtiness makes farming an ideal target for robots, especially since farms also offer repetitive tasks in a semi-constrained environment. At Harper Adams University, they are taking farmer autonomy ideas very seriously, serious enough that they have managed to plant, tend, and harvest an acre and a half of barley using only autonomous vehicles and drones. During the hands-free hectare project, no human set foot on the field between planting and harvest. Everything was done by robots. This includes drilling channels in the dirt for the barley seeds to be planted at specific depths and intervals with an autonomous tractor, spraying a series of fungicides, herbicides, fertilizers when and where necessary, and then harvesting the barley with an autonomous combine. Modern farming is much more complicated than just dropping some seeds on the ground and then coming back later for tasty food. The amount of composition of the pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and even the timing of the final harvest depends on a data-driven understanding of the state of the crop. And to make these decisions, robot scouts, including drones and ground robots, surveyed the field from time to time, sending back measurements and bringing back samples for humans to have a look at from the comfort of someplace warm, dry, and clean. The automated harvest took place just a few days ago after samples confirmed that the barley was dry enough. And in this video down below, it is the first test cut, and the entire harvest took only about 6 hours. Overall, the field produced 4.5 metric tons per hectare, which is significantly less than the average of 6.8 metric tons per hectare that you could expect from conventional human-intensive farming methods. Well, good, then screw all the robots. The students involved in the hands-free project also suggested that this was probably the most expensive hectare of barley ever, with an overall budget of £200,000 from the UK government. Moonshots like this are understandably expensive, though, since a large chunk of that money went to capital costs like buying a tractor and a harvester, the next crop will be vastly cheaper. While it is possible that at some point there might be significant labor savings by fully automating farming like this, there are a lot of other and more immediate benefits with fully autonomous farm vehicles. You can use a bunch of smaller ones much more effectively than a few larger ones, and that is the trend that has been going if you need a human sitting in the driver's seat. That means higher precision, minimal soil compaction, cost savings, and increased flexibility to deal with mechanical breakdowns. With the need for daylight, you could keep a farm active 24/7 with a very small human workforce just there, and even checking in remotely as a supervisory capacity. Robots, so just dial into the farm, make sure it's all going right, and then go back to sleep. Robots are only going to get more affordable and efficient at this sort of thing, and our guess is that it won't be very long before fully autonomous farming passes conventional farming methods in both overall output and sustainability. You know, they could have a little Roomba home farmer to tend an acre of crops, Actually, that would be a pretty good little invention there. Anyone wants to run with it? And you could remotely control it by your cell phone, small mobile robots, or distributed sensor systems could constantly monitor crops and chase away critters that are going to come eat them. Ultrasonic deer sounds, weep, 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 chases them out of the way. It would be impractical for human workers. Feeding data into the system that could provide, for example, plant-by-plant recommendations for chemical treatments that a location-aware spraying system could then dispense. And with robots like the Deep Fields Weed Puncher and even Tetrals ready to help out as much as they can, person-free precision farming seems like an increasingly viable way to help keep the world fed. Hands-free Hector team is already looking forward to their next winter crop. And in the meantime, they are, of course, taking all of that spring barley and turning it into hands-free Hector beer. And that's exactly what I was thinking. There's going to be, like, hands-free beer out there. All right, so here's another one. And this is what got me thinking about Elon Musk and some of this that is going on. Internet-connected construction equipment. Well, yes, Iridium Communications says yes. The communications company is beginning to roll out services using a new satellite constellation, and it thinks that construction equipment can benefit. It has been a busy year for Iridium Communications. The company has been sending its next-generation satellite constellation into orbit, and the fruits of that labor are beginning to be realized. Here is what investors need to know. Iridium is building 81 satellites, dubbed Next Satellites, that'll provide new services and capabilities for its customers. For the total, 66 will operate in orbit, 15 will serve as in-orbit spares, and 6 will be held back as ground spares. SpaceX has been hired to launch these satellites in 8 batches. The first 2 were dispatched a year earlier, and the next 6 liftoffs will be completed by the end of 2018. The new satellites will power new and improved communication services for companies and government organizations that require globe-spanning services. Next will enable broadband speeds for data services, Internet of Things applications like asset tracking, and next-generation air traffic surveillance systems like for drones. It will also take 66 operational satellites to provide 100% global coverage. Iridium recently announced that it began testing its new Certus communication service on satellites and has thus far been put into operation. Once fully deployed, Certus will provide data speeds of up to 1.4 megabytes, which is enough speed for high-definition video streaming. And while it is still too soon to tell how the new constellation will ultimately affect Iridium's business, the company has reported some early wins. It announced on September 27th that Iridium has signed a long-term deal with Hitachi Construction Machinery to provide global coverage for Hitachi's e-service machinery management system. By tapping into Iridium's network, the expanded service will now bring internet connections to the owners of Hitachi equipment everywhere around the globe. Hitachi's now global e-service management system provides equipment customers with information like CO2 emissions, equipment idling times, and fuel consumption. Equipment operation information can be helpful in managing crews, scheduling preventative maintenance, and tracking equipment locations. Adding Iridium into the mix opens up these capabilities for contractors and organizations that do work in remote and hard-to-reach areas. More important for Iridium is adding Hitachi into its fold helps the company expand its IoT services. And during the second quarter that ended June 30th, commercial machine-to-machine subscribers increased 20% to 461,000. Government machine-to-machine subscribers were up over 19% to over 44,000. And actual machine-to-machine revenue is only up 15%. Though, as the average revenue customer is down. On the back of those new services, the company thinks the total revenue can rise by about 30% in 2019. In the interim, though, 2017 revenues are expected 3-5% to be up. And year to date, the company is on track to hit those numbers. So we're not going to invest in them. But just know that Hitachi Construction now is going to be able to enable the Internet of Things and their construction equipment. And imagine what's going to happen in the future once they put real-time GPS onto these construction equipment. pieces of equipment so they will be able to remotely dig and remotely control them, like we were just talking about with the autonomous barley harvesting. So here are SpaceX's next 12 launches scheduled for 2017. So when I started looking into this, I started noticing some interesting things about SpaceX and Elon Musk's affiliations. We had talked about Elon Musk inking a partnership with NASA for using the Kennedy Space Station and Kennedy Space, whatever it's called, port, and Cape Canaveral a long time ago. He leased that space, and he got access to some of their scientists. Listen to this. SpaceX is incredibly busy in 2017, and it is only going to get busier. This was from July 10th, 2017. SpaceX CEO and founder Elon Musk posted a short recap of where the company's year is so far on Instagram. 10 launches down, 12 more to go. We are currently a little more than halfway through the year. Let's take a look at some of their schedules. So in August, they launched the CRS-12 out of Cape Canaveral, and that was a resupply mission to the International Space Station. Then they also launched the Formosat from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and it was an observational satellite launch for the government of Taiwan. Then in August, they also launched the X-37B, which is the secretive, we talked about the X-37B a long time ago, is the secretive little mini space shuttle that originally was part of the space shuttle program that got shut down by Obama. But then I think DARPA took it, and then the Air Force took it as part of Space Command, and they set it on like four or five missions that were labeled as top secret to fly unmanned at the border of space and the atmosphere. But you don't know what it's doing. But Elon Musk launched that. He just launched another one recently. I just posted. In September, he then did a launch for this Iridium Next that we had just talked about, enabling the Internet of Things in space. And that was done at the Vandenberg Air Force Base as well. SpaceX is sending up 10 mini satellites as part of the Iridium satellite constellation. This is the third Iridium Next launch, carrying satellites 21 through 30. And SpaceX has a lot more planned. In November, SpaceX is launching a CRS-13 in Cape Canaveral. This is yet another resupply mission. This is SpaceX is expected to try flying a reused Dragon spacecraft for this one, but further testing for the reusability of all of its equipment. In December, they are launching the Bangabandhu 1 out of Cape Canaveral. This is Bangladesh's first geostationary communication satellite. It'll be operated and regulated by Bangladesh, and this would be in India, another one of our offshore mad science development countries. Bangladesh's Telecommunications Regulatory Commission, an independent commission that covers pretty much all communications in the country. It also has a habit of banning atheist blogs and websites, which is less exciting. So we're launching this for Bangladesh from Cape Canaveral. Then in late 2017, November, December, the SES-11 from Cape Canaveral. SES has been contracted with SpaceX for years, launching communication satellites to broaden its network. And its last launch, the SES-10, was the first commercial launch of a reused orbital-class rocket, which speaks both to SpaceX's achievement and SES trust in the company. There's also the SAOCOM-1A from Vandenberg Air Force Base in December. The SAOCOM-1A is an Argentinian observational satellite that will be mainly used to monitor for natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes. Then there's the KoreaSat-5A. This is a Korean communication satellite serving much of Eastern Asia. Then the Iridium Next 4 from Vandenberg. This is another wave of 10 satellites for the Iridium constellation. And then the SES-16 Cape Canaveral. It's a military satellite from the government of Luxembourg that will help with NATO missions. What? And this is what SpaceX is involved in. Then there's also the Falcon Heavy demonstration flight from Cape Canaveral. This is a big one, which Musk said should start in late summer but could permanently get moved back. SpaceX hasn't yet confirmed any prospective launch dates, but the launch is going to be a tight squeeze if it is going up for the summer, and I don't know if it did. It is possible that any of these flights could change. Of course, SpaceX has a fifth Iridium Next flight tentatively scheduled for December 31st that is probably going to get moved into 2018, and there are a handful of other missions that might be rotated in, but whatever happens, the end of 2017 is looking even busier than the start. So, I then had another story, and this was October 16th, 2017. Weather finally cooperates, so this was yesterday, for early morning Atlas V launch. After a series of weather and technical delays this month, United Launch Alliance was able to finally get a payload for the military into space. The Atlas V rocket took off from Cape Canaveral's Air Force Station Space Launch Complex on Sunday, and the NROL-52 mission for the National Reconnaissance Office. The payload is classified, but in its support of national security, is thought to be part of the agency's space data system, which relays data between satellites and supports the Air Force. Today's launch is a testament to the tireless dedication of the team, demonstrating why it continues to serve as our nation's most dependable and successful launch provider. After recovering from Hurricane Irma that came through the area last month, and last week's weather challenges, the team found the right opportunity today to deliver this critical national asset to orbit. The launch was the seventh in 2017 and is the 26th launch for the National Reconnaissance Office. This is a collaboration between Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and this next launch is for the Joint Polar Satellite System for NASA and the National Oceanic Atmospheric Observatory Administration will be November 10th from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. So Musk is launching satellites from where Boeing and Lockheed Martin are, and from where our national, is some sort of surveillance satellite is being launched. He is in the know, and he is fighting with the big boys to launch satellites. The next launch from Cape Canaveral will be from SpaceX, which plans to launch its Falcon 9 rocket with the KryoStat-5A communications satellite from Kennedy Space Center on October 30th. And those are them apples. Oh, and then this one, September 7th, Elon Musk launches the X-37B. Billionaire tech titan Elon Musk suggested that the global race for artificial intelligence would be the cause for World War III, and that governments would take AI technology at gunpoint if necessary. Now, as SpaceX has launched a secret space drone for the Pentagon Thursday in September, Elon Musk's exploration company launched the Air Force's clandestine unmanned X-37B space vehicle from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It is the fifth launch for the X-37B space vehicle, but is the first time that SpaceX has facilitated the launch. It was revealed that Musk won the contract in June. The Air Force is mostly not clear about its intentions for the X-37B orbital test vehicle. Details on the 29-foot drone and its mission are scant and vague. The X-37B Orbital Test Vehicle, or OTV, is an experimental test program to demonstrate technologies for a reliable, reusable, unmanned space test platform for the Air Force. And the primary objectives for the X-37B are twofold: a reusable spacecraft technology for America's future in space, and operating experiments which can be returned to and examined on Earth. Notably, though, the X-37B can stay both orbiting in space for months, up to 270 days, and return experiments to Earth for further inspection and analysis, according to the site. Hopefully, it is not the weaponized MRSA that they sent up with Elon Musk SpaceX to the space station. SpaceX completed the launch of a mysterious unmanned Air Force vehicle, despite earlier warnings that the weathercast was only 50% favorable. because of Hurricane Irma. And yeah, this was the flight that took off right before the hurricane. Musk's launch of the Air Force space vehicle comes just a few months after the House of Representatives proposed the first ever, and I thought this was interesting, quote unquote, Space Corps in the National Defense Authorization Bill. This Space Corps, the bill says, would be a division of the Department of the Air Force and would be established on January 1st, 2019. It would create effectively a branch of the military to operate in space, protecting the interests of the United States. According to Alabama Republican Representative Mike Rogers, who serves on the House Armed Services Committee, Space Corps would focus on space domination, he wrote for the Washington Post. The bill passed the House in July, but has yet to be considered by the Senate. According to GovTrack, the public records where government legislation is in the creation process. So there you go, a Space Corps. And I'd like to know, maybe if I click on this, it'll tell us who is involved in Space Corps. This is the H.R. 2810 National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2018. And I don't know if you can search anything or how I'm going to find Space Corps. Oh, summary. Hold on. How about if I do a Control F? S-P-A-C-E. National security. Here we go. The bill establishes a new U.S. Space Corps as a separate military service within the Department of the Air Force by 2019. The bill also establishes a U.S. Space Command and a new sub-unified command within U.S. Strategic Command. So is that all? Hold on. Yeah, national security, space, and that's it. That's all it says. There's just four little listings for space here, and then cyberspace. So who knows what the Space Corps is or who is involved? So getting back to Elon Musk, Michael from Primer Time sent me a link to a brand new BBC show that started just recently called Tomorrow's World. And they had their very first podcast. It was from October 12, 2017. And they talked about this new, and I'm assuming that this is a new project out of Elon Musk's Neuralink. And they talked with one of the engineers that was involved. And this new project is called Wizard's Hat. And when they were explaining it, it sounded to me almost like some sort of implant with little tendrils that grow out of it. And it's all about merging man with the machine and being able to have brain-machine interfacing. Not only do they hope that we will be able to control technology with our thoughts, but they are working towards human beings being able to transmit information directly into another's brain, taking factual ideas into sensory inputs. So don the wizard's hat and your headphones for the next episode. And guys, this is serious stuff. And Elon is saying, if you can't beat him, join him. But he is also one of the people who is helping facilitate this creation of the global Internet of Things by launching these communication satellites for not only commercialistic endeavors such as Iridium's, but also for government agencies in the X-37B. There's all kinds of theories as to what that device is being used for and all kinds of things that they are trying to control. But guys, just know that radio frequencies are very, very powerful energies that they have been experimenting with since the 1930s. With some of their experimentation with Bell Labs, and we looked a lot into Bell Labs. Go back and find those shows. I have a playlist with over 600 shows on YouTube, and you can find all of those if you go to my UCY page, ucy.tv/BTFC for Before the First Cup. Down at the very bottom, I should list all of those episodes with titles. But we talked a lot about Bell Labs. and a lot about frequencies and a lot about communications technologies and how this is all rolled out and lots of inventions that came long before the times we ever thought that they were even possible. And we found that the military has been experimenting with microwaves for a very long time. But remember, this DARPA communication challenge, the Grand Spectrum Communication Challenge, is talking about getting rid of the Federal Communications Commission and the licensing of communication bands, like the way the system runs now, and giving the entire communication electromagnetic spectrum to the artificial intelligence and letting it dynamically allocate slices of that spectrum on an as needed basis. Based upon, I'm trying to remember the term we used to use in engineering when you were trying to engineer voice and you give it priority. So based upon the organizations that are given priority, such as your military would probably be number one, I would imagine. And then maybe even some of your internet service providers and some of your large global organizations. And then down to your little puny human websites at the end that are going to maybe in your little rinky-dink local ISP, your cell phones, your texts, they will be the lowest priority of all. But they want to dynamically allocate the electromagnetic spectrum. And weaponry, you will probably bet, will be number one. But guys, don't think that they cannot remotely control biology and influence frequencies. I was just reading something, and I closed my Facebook page, but hold on. There was a very interesting story in the last minute here that I posted about them using nanotechnology in vibration. Here we go. This is out of nanotech-now.com. Vibrating nanoparticles interact, and placing nanodiscs in groups can change their vibrational frequencies. It almost made me think of societies and people and how there's always that dynamic of negative versus positive, and people who are the out-of-tune instrument in the orchestra tend to make things go bad. Like a tuning fork struck with a mallet, tiny gold nanodiscs can be made to vibrate at resonant frequencies when struck by light. Remember, light and sound are very intimately connected. In new research this week, Rice University chemist Stephen Link and colleagues showed how to selectively alter those vibrational frequencies by gathering different sized nanodiscs into a group. That made me think of what is micro is macro. Let's go out to outer space and think about how there is this whole electric universe out there and these large discs with gravity in groups that are vibrating and have resonant frequencies and sound all between them by their motions and the physics that exists. Like a tuning fork struck with a mallet, nanodiscs can be made to vibrate at resonance frequencies when struck by light. In new research, they find that the tuning fork analogy, it would, if we could alter the sounds by several vibrating forks and bringing them close together. But what on a nanoscale, you do not hear that tonal shift. Instead, we see a tiny change in color. And we have shown that by grouping nanodiscs, we can shift their acoustical resonance in an orderly and predictable way, which could be useful in optomechanics. Optomechanics is the merging branch of physics, material science, and nanophotonics that focuses on the interactions between light and mechanical devices. Optomechanic systems are used in telecommunications, microscopy, quantum computing, and sensors using lasers and interferometers that detect the first gravity waves in 2016. This is some pretty high-end stuff, guys, and it can all be manipulated with vibration, and they can change acoustical resonances. Don't think that they can't be done to us, and as they get the nanobots inside of us... And these little nanorobots it'll be ever more plausible. All right, guys, make sure you have an awesome Tuesday, and I will catch up with you Tuesday.